Good afternoon, everybody. It is 3 o'clock, Tuesday afternoon, April 27th. And we're going to talk a little bit more about these chemical reactions, the Michael-Aldall reaction. And if memory serves me correctly, we left off scaling the first reaction, but not scaling the second reaction. And you guys were going to maybe look at scaling the second reaction yourselves, maybe, possibly, some people. We're thinking about maybe doing that. Nobody did it this morning, so I would not be surprised if nobody did it this afternoon, which is Mary's owning it. She's owning it. Okay. Let me go ahead and start screen share. Wait, that's recording. That's screen share. Oh, it worked smoother that time. That's better. Okay, with all my computer updates that I was doing, every time I wanted to screen share now, it was giving me a cue that something was trying to access my computer and the certain ports, and it would go through four or five ports, and I had to keep like hitting all these acknowledge buttons, but I think we've got it sorted out now that it knows what it's doing. Okay, so the reaction that we were going to look at, this is experiment number 38. And we were going to scale for 2 millimoles. So that's the job. And experiment 38 looks like this. It was the chalcone molecule that we would have created in experiment 37. And this molecule would have had an R group on it. So we'll deal with the R group a little bit later. Right now, we're going to treat it as a hydrogen. This is with ethyl acetoacetate. Ethanol and sodium hydroxide. And we were trying to make the six-membered ring system. It's a big molecule, the biggest that we've worked with in lab throughout both semesters. There we go. Okay, and so that's the product that we're trying to make. And the question is, what scale was this reaction done with? All right, so I'm gonna take the R group off for a minute. And I'm going to look at what they're giving me. They're giving me 0.24 grams of this chalcone and 0.15 of the ethyl acetoacetate, 5 milliliters of ethanol, and 0.25 milliliter, 0.25 of a 2 molar. Of the sodium hydroxide. So those are all the things that went into it. And as I said, what we were hoping to do.
If you wrote those down, they didn't, it might be frozen.
It froze. Frozone. That is so frustrating when it does that, because there's nothing that I can do to prevent it.
Jason, also, sorry if I'm late to the party, but why are we talking about experiment 38?
You are late to the party, dude. The reason we're talking about 38 is because in experiment 64 that describes these two reactions, what they tell you, here, we'll back up. We'll slide this down. It may have gone down too far. We can bring it back up a minute too. In experiment 64, they tell you that they want you to do this. They want you to take acetophenone and react it with a benzaldehyde derivative. They want you to do that in ethanol with a sodium hydroxide solution that is fairly strong. It's like 10 molar or 12 molar, somewhere in that range. This makes the calcone. And then from the calcone with this R group on it, now you can take and you can react this with ethyl acetoacetate. It's really hard to fit all this in on one line. You can react this with ethyl acetoacetate in order to do the next reaction, which they say is a Michael Aldall. It's really a Robinson annulation reaction that you're doing. Sodium hydroxide, and then this makes the large six-membered ring system. And what they tell you is they want you to make approximately a millimole of this. And they don't tell you how to do it. So they say you want to make approximately one millimole, and that's your goal. And they say that you look back at, in order to understand how to do all of this, this piece here is experiment 37. And this piece here is experiment 38. And so in order to do this with a goal of one millimole, we have to look back at 37, look back at 38. And we have to scale these experiments appropriately to try to get to the one millimole. So that's the whole thing of where that's going. And so what we did is we said that this reaction is going to run in approximately a 50% yield. And we're going to assume that this reaction is also going to run in approximately a 50% yield. Now, it may run in much better yield, or it could run in worse yield, but we're going to assume that both of them run in 50% yield. And if we want one millimole of this, then if it ran in 50% yield, I needed to start with two millimoles. And if this one runs in 50% yield and I want to get two millimoles of this, then I need to start with four millimoles of this. So we have backtracked, going back this way, to desire a four millimole scale. Now, what we did in the last class is we talked about how to scale this to four millimoles. And so we looked at scaling experiment 37 to a four millimole level. We scaled number 37 from one millimole to our required four millimole. Today, we need to scale number 38. Two millimoles. And look at how to do that. So that's why I was bringing all of this in. And yes, we're doing experiment 64, but 64 has no inherent instructions in it. Everything within 64 just tells you to look back at 37 and 38. So that's where all that comes from. And I thought that this was of value because while we can't really go in and do the lab, understanding how to scale a lab and how to do these skill sets is the next level important thing. I mean, it's one thing to go into a kitchen and to be able to follow a cookbook and open up a cookbook and be able to cook whatever it is that, you know, that is there and follow the recipe and know how to do all that. It's a whole nother thing when you can walk into a kitchen and you can make your own recipes and make your own dishes and make your own things. And so that's where this skill set is leading us. It's how do I set up a reaction? How do I design a reaction? And how do I make everything work? Okay, so what we need to do from here is we need to be able to take each one of these items and first look at what scale is experiment 38. And then secondly, we need to scale it up. So scaling it to 2 millimoles is not as easy as just taking everything and saying, all right, I'm just going to multiply everything by 2, because we don't know what scale it's at. So first we need to know what scale it's at. And if it's a 1 millimole scale, then we can just multiply everything by 2. But if it's not, then we need to create a scaling factor. And we need to multiply everything by a scaling factor. And so that's kind of where we're at. So we've got the Chalcone. We have ethyl acetoacetate. We've got ethanol and sodium hydroxide. And really what we're concerned with primarily is these guys are going to tell us what the ratio is and what the scale of the reaction is. And so we need to know kind of their molar mass to start off with. This guy here, the Chalcone, is what, a C6, 12, 13, 14, 15, C15. H5, 10, 15, 11, 12, 12. And O. And ethyl acetoacetate is C1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, C6. H3, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, O3. So I'm coming out with those values. And then we should get these molar masses really quick. And then we'll calculate out what the scale is. When you're calculating out the molar masses, a lot of people just freak out if they don't have it in the textbook, or they Google it, and if it doesn't come up on Google, then they freak out. And you just need to remember that. I mean, it's funny because you're in lab and you've gone through Chem 1A, Chem 1B. You should be able to do this like with your eyes closed. But sometimes people forget that it's a skill set that is not that hard. We're not doing mass spec, so we don't use the whole numbers. In this case, what we want to do is use the average atomic masses for each one of these elements in order to calculate out what the atomic mass for the molecule is. So we've got 15 carbons times the mass of carbon, 12.01. You could do it at 4 sig figs, or if you've got a memorized to more, or you've got a periodic table with more, you could do it with more, 12.0114 plus what, 12 times 1.00794 plus 15.9994. So we're at 208.27. Grams per mole for that, and 6 times 12.0114 plus 0.794 plus 3 times 15.94, 131.07. Okay, so there's those two. And I'm going to ignore the solvent and the sodium hydroxide for right now. So just checking that, and you can see if I missed my numbers or something, or I'm off the mark, you can let me know. But by 5 sig figs, that looks like where we're at. And then to go through and calculate out the millimoles, we'll take for the Chalcone, and it was 0.24 grams. It looks like we were at 208.27. And then millimoles is easier. When you were doing Chem 1A and Chem 1B, you never dealt with millimoles. In fact, millimoles never even sounded like it was a thing. Although, if you think about moles as a value and putting a metric prefix in front of it, it makes perfect sense. And every reaction that we do is on a millimole scale, and it just makes it a much easier number to talk about. You know, if you're doing 5 millimoles or 2 millimoles or 1.5 millimoles, it's an easy thing rather than saying I'm dealing with 0.0015 moles. It's just easier to deal in millimoles. And so organic reactions, we almost always talk about it in this way. So it's a 1.15 millimole is what that guy is. Ethyl acetoacetate that's going to be 0.15 grams times 1.07 grams per mole. And then multiply that by 1,000. .15 divided by 131.07 times 1,000. And that's right in the same ballpark, 1.14. So it's a little bit bigger than 1 millimole. I mean, we could round it out, but the problem is that all the numbers would have to be adjusted. And it's easier to come up with the scaling factor. So the scaling factor, the way that I do this is that, you know, you have your reaction and you want to multiply this in order to equal 2 millimoles. That's what you're desiring to do. So your reaction was a 1.14 or 1.15 millimole. So we're going to multiply this by 1.15 millimoles and times 2 millimoles. And this is our scaling factor. And so if we take and we make it just a 3 sig fig thing, then 2 divided by 1.15 equals 1.74. And that's our scaling factor. So what we're going to do is we're going to multiply everything by 1.14. To make a 2 millimole reaction. So that's how we go through and do it. And now it's just a matter of taking that reaction as it was set up.
Jason, sorry, I just, you used 1.15 and not 1.14. Would you use the limiting reactant for this? Whatever.
Yes. I think that what they did essentially, if I look at it, is I would guess that let's see, why did they do that? I'm trying to think if there was a reason why they had it in a slight excess for the calcone. Ethyl acetoacetate, I suppose, could react together. I think that what they really wanted to do, though, is I think they really wanted to make the calcone and the ethyl acetoacetate identical. I think they wanted them to be the same number of millimoles, but the 0.15 was a nice round number rather than going 0.15 3, whatever it would take to get it to the 1.15 millimoles. I think they just rounded out the number, which is sometimes what we do when we go to the balance. We always just round up the number. And so I'm just going to scale it and say that the 1.15 is just an easier number. Whether you went 1.15 or 1.14 and your scaling factor was just a little bit different, it's going to come out in the wash. It's going to be fine, because you have to remember that what you're doing here is you're getting the numbers for what you would ideally put into the chemical reaction. But when you go and you actually obtain your masses and your volumes, all those numbers are going to be slightly different, and you're going to have to calculate what your limiting reagent is from those numbers in order to be able to calculate what your percent yield is for the reaction when you actually run it anyway. So your numbers are never, I mean, this is, I guess, how many times do you go into the kitchen and you're going to cook something and it tells you to measure exactly 1 teaspoon? How many of us actually scrape off that teaspoon to get it perfectly level before dumping it in? I'm just the sort of dump it in there kind of guy. And with organic chemistry, it's a little like horseshoes. You're trying to get close, but it doesn't have to be spot on all the time. And then we calculate out what our percent yield is from that. Of course, you could sit there and spend an enormous amount of time trying to measure everything precisely and getting all those numbers just right, but you'll never get done in the 3-hour period. You're always going to be lagging behind because you were struggling to try to get everything just perfect. And the reality is that the organic chemical reaction doesn't require that. And so there's a little bit of flexibility. Please, Bibi.
So when I did the calculations, I did it with the Chalcone that they used with that R group on it.
Yes. And
so my question is, because that definitely changes the numbers.
It does.
If that was the case, would you use the limiting reagent, which happens to be the Chalcone, for the scaling factor? Or
so there's two things at play here. One of them is that in the book, this was meant to be a general procedure. And the values that they chose, if you read it, they say use 0.24 grams of finely ground trans calcone. And they don't specify which one exactly. They leave that a little bit open. And when you calculate the millimoles and you do it as if there was no R group on it, they come out to be almost identical millimoles, 1-to-1 factor. If you put the R group on it with the 2 oxygens and the CH2 group, then the mass becomes higher. The calcone then becomes the limiting reagent and is substantially less, probably even less than a millimole. It's probably 0.9 something. And so, yes, you'll see variation there. I think that the intention was that this was supposed to be a 1-to-1. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take and use that scaling factor to figure out the amount of the ethyl acetoacetate, the amount of the ethanol, the amount of the sodium hydroxide. But then I'm going to calculate 2 millimoles exactly of whatever derivative I get assigned in the class between the chloro, the nitro, all those different derivatives. I will go back and I'll calculate exactly 2 millimoles of that and how much I'm supposed to use to set up my reaction. So it's the difference between building the reaction for a specific and looking at the general. And all of the reagents besides the calcone are general. The calcone is specific. So we'll see that in a second. We'll get there. But that's a great observation and important. So I agree. All right. This is looking this way. And this is the ethyl acetoacetate. And the ethanol. And the sodium hydroxide. And we had 0.15 grams of this. We're going to multiply this by our 1.74. So we're going to need 0.26 grams. Come on, go away. There it goes. Now I forgot the number. 0.26 grams of that. We started off with 5 milliliters. We'll multiply that by 1.74, and we started off with 0.25 milliliters. We'll multiply that by 1.74. So this is just giving us each of the components that we need. So this is 8.7 mils and 0.25 times 1.74. This is 5. So we round even, 0.44 round even. Okay, so there's that. And then there's a workup that's in this where we add 2 mils of water. And we'll multiply that as well. So that's another 3.5. And then this guy was at 0.25 grams or 0.24 grams. And that's 0.42. All right, so what I'm going to do then is I'm going to add all of those things up. To get to my total volume. I'm going to treat this 0.42 here as if that is a volume. So 0.42 plus 0.26 plus 8.7 plus 0.44 plus 3.5. Total volume is 13.32. Which means that when I look at this, I'm going to go ahead and go with a 25 mil round bottom. So we've got that all sort of scaled and know what size round bottom we're going to go ahead and use for that reaction. That's all the planning part. And then we can look specifically at the reaction that we want to run and how we're going to put that reaction together. So specifically now, what we would say is, let's just say that we were assigned the nitro derivative. And what we were going to do is we were going to put this reaction together with the nitro derivative. The nitro one is going to have the NO2 in that position on the calcone. Everything else is going to be exactly as it was. Nothing else is going to change. I don't know why I keep trying to do the oxygen in the middle. So based on my volumes, what I would do is 8.7 milliliters, 0.44 milliliters, 0.26 grams, but of this guy here, I want 2 millimoles because this is already scaled. That was already taken into account in the scale. And what I need to do is I need to figure out how much of this is 2 millimoles. So what I'll do is I'll take 0.002 moles and I'll multiply it by the molar mass that for every 1 mole of this, I need to know what its formula is and how many grams per mole it is. So we've got 6, 12, 13, 14, 15. I've got 5 and 4 is 9, 10, 11, and 03. That's going to be 15 times carbon plus 11 times hydrogen plus 1 nitrogen plus 3 oxygens. If I did that all correctly, we're at 253.26. And then I'll just take that answer and multiply that answer by 0.002 to give me the 2 millimoles. So that's 0.51 grams to 2 sig figs if I want that route. And that's what I would start with. So that would be my whole reaction. If I were doing the nitro derivative and I wanted to set this up at 2 millimoles, I'd weigh out 0.51 grams of this material, react it with 0.26 grams of the ethyl acetoacetate, 8.7 milliliters of ethanol, and 0.44 milliliters of sodium hydroxide. The only thing that I haven't asked is, this is a 2 millimole reaction. What is my concentration? I'm just curious. 0.002 moles. Let's see, concentration is in moles per liter, and I'm in 8.7 milliliters. And by the time I add in those next four, I'm roughly just a little over 9 milliliters. So let's divide this by 0.009 milliliters. That would be right. So I am roughly 0.22 molar. So why did I do that? The reason that I did that is because how much solvent do I use for a chemical reaction? How much ethanol do I add? How important is the ethanol? What happens if I add more ethanol or less ethanol? Why do I choose a particular amount of ethanol to use as a solvent? How do I even decide what is the right amount? The solvent is there to support the chemical reaction. The solvent has to be there to support your reactants and your products. If your reactants precipitate out, the chemical reaction will not go forward. If the intermediates that are formed during the chemical reaction precipitate out, the chemical reaction will not go forward. So there needs to be enough solvent to be able to solvate your starting materials. But not so much that it becomes so dilute that they can't find one another. Remember that the rates for these chemical reactions, if we consider this to be a bimolecular rate constant, the rate is probably something on the order of the concentration of the calcone times the rate of the ethyl acetoacetate. And so as these concentrations go up, the rate goes up. As those concentrations go down, the rate goes down and the reaction will start to take longer. But it's a balancing act between making sure that everything stays soluble, but also concentrated enough that the rate is reasonable for the reaction to take place. And so I think that in going back to that recipe idea of being able to go into a kitchen and put together a chemical reaction, it's good to look at chemical reactions and see for chemical reactions that are well designed, what is their concentration in terms of the reactants? And knowing that their concentrations may be somewhere between half molar and quarter molar is a common sort of concentration to be able to see for most chemical reactions, which allows you then to have that sort of in your mind that when you want to go in and run a reaction, you can aim for about half molar to quarter molar and reasonably have it run okay. And if it needs to be adjusted for solubility, then you adjust up or down for solubility as sort of need be if you think see things precipitating out during the course of starting to try to run the chemical reaction. So that was just something I wanted to note on the side there really quick. Okay, so we know how to run this. We know how to go in and run the reaction. The next thing that I want to talk about real quick is the idea of these different substituents. The substituents that we have are the methoxy group. There's a chloro. There's a nitro. And a methyl. Any idea as to the nature of these different types of groups? Well, maybe before I ask that, maybe what I ought to ask is, in terms of these chemical reactions, let's look at the first reaction. Then we'll come back to those groups in just a second. Reaction number 37. Reaction number 37 takes and starts off by pulling the proton and creating the enolate. And then that enolate attacks the aldehyde, the substituted aldehyde. And we have the R group here. And this comes in, and this attacks here, and that opens up. And this is the rate determining step. Is the carbon-carbon bond making step. And that step then forms the first adduct. On the way to making the calcone.
I think it froze again.
Okay. Oh, it did indeed. It's not liking this update. But you guys are catching it. I wish I could figure out what makes it freeze. Okay, so the important part here is this. This is the rate determining step. And what we have is this is acting as a nucleophile, and this guy is your electrophile. So in a reaction diagram, this goes on to more steps, by the way, but we're not going to look at the rest of those steps because we're really only concerned with that rate determining step and understanding what influences that rate determining step. So when we look at an energy diagram of this, the energy diagram is going to look like this. We're going to go from one thing to this charged intermediate, but then to this next part, which is up here. See if I can get this to snap in the way that I want it to. Come on. Sometimes it wants to do it, and sometimes you got to really exaggerate it in order to get it to work. Okay, so it looks something like this for the chemical reaction. And actually, this guy is a little bit lower. And this is our rate determining step. And what we're making here is this piece. And over here, we're at the enolate. And the benzaldehyde. Okay, and we're concerned about the understanding what is affecting this chemical reaction at the point of the transition state. And so we have to look at either side of this chemical reaction. On this side over here, we have the enolate and the benzaldehyde. On this side over here, we have the adduct that is formed. And energy-wise, because we're going up in energy, because this thing is less stable, what is really influencing this chemical reaction as our rate determining step is the highest activation energy is the fact that what this R group is doing to stabilize or destabilize this intermediate. And so what we're using is we're going to use Hammond postulate. And we're going to link these two here in the transition state using Hammond. And anything that is going to increase the energy of this system, destabilizing that anion, is also going to raise my activation energy and destabilize my reaction. Anything that stabilizes this intermediate is going to stabilize and lower my activation energy. And so that is going to play into this group as what is the nature of that R group? Is that R group stabilizing or destabilizing? And so now we can go back and we can look at our R groups, where our R groups were methoxy, chloro, nitro, and methyl. And we can think about how each one of these R groups would impact this chemical reaction. Now, this isn't normally part of what I do for this reaction. Normally what I do is in introducing the reaction, I simply say the R group is going to play a role. And we don't know what that role is going to be. And so you're going to run your reaction and some of them are going to fail and some of them are going to work. And those that fail, you're going to have to figure out why they failed. And then you're going to have to figure out how to rectify that, how to make it better. Now, since we can't just go in and do the experiment, and since I'm not going to tell you which ones fail and which ones don't, I want us to work from the theoretical side and predict which ones are going to go really fast and which ones are going to slow down. So we need to think about how these groups here affect the stability of the anion on the oxygen. And there's no direct resonance. So yes, I can push resonance into this aromatic ring, but once I get there, there's a hydrogen that is on this carbon, and that's an sp3 hybridized carbon. And so I can't do any resonance in or out of that oxygen. All I can do is inductive sort of stabilization or destabilization. So this is all going to work by induction. So what I want to know is I want to know my donating groups and I want to know my withdrawing groups and I want to rank them. Mm. and I want to have them, you know, strongest withdrawing, working from the donating group. So the nitro group is going to be the most stabilizing. Yeah, because the nitro is the strongest withdrawing group. So yes, I would agree that our nitro group, as we come in here and we put the nitro group in here, it's supposed to be NO2, that the NO2 group is going to be my strongest withdrawing group. Now, what about the other groups here? We've got methoxy and chloro. Which one of those is more withdrawing inductively, a chlorine or an oxygen? It's a harder choice. You haven't really had to think about the electronegativity of chlorine and where it sits.
Methoxy?
Methoxy, yeah. The oxygen is really a monster. This is 3.5 in terms of electronegativity, and chlorine is closer to like 2.7. I don't think it's even 3.0. It might be close to 3.0, but I think it's closer to 2.7. And carbon's 2.5. So yeah, the methoxy is the stronger group. So we get methoxy in here, and then we get chloro. And then that leaves the methyl, and the methyl group is, as we've seen before, primarily an electron donating group. So what we can see out of this is we can see that, and I think I color-coded my things entirely wrong.
Yeah,
I did, didn't I? Because I'm always thinking that red is sort of like destabilizing, but in this case, it's the electron withdrawing groups that are stabilizing. And so style, change it. That in this case, it is the donating groups which are destabilizing, and it is the withdrawing groups which are stabilizing. And so these guys here are going to make the reaction run faster. And the methyl group is going to run slower. And interestingly, what happens is for the nitro derivative, just as we were talking and I was saying we were scaling this for the nitro and I was going to give everybody the nitro group, that the nitro group runs so fast that it runs too fast. And when you go to put the base into the chemical reaction, the reaction immediately turns black. And then you get all of this black precipitate that comes out of the reaction, and the reaction solidifies and stops spinning. And it does it almost instantaneously. And it does it within like the first 5 drops of the sodium hydroxide before you've even put all the sodium hydroxide into it. So it accelerates this reaction to such a degree that, that the reaction runs too fast and the product chars and leads to a lot of side products, which are the black products that we're seeing in this chemical reaction. So the question then is, if the reaction is running too fast, what are ways that I could slow this reaction down?
Temperature
is one. So so let's say problem. Here's the problem. The nitro is too activating, and we need to slow the reaction down. So how can we slow it down? So ways to slow it down. Number one, we had temperature. Cool it down. Take it down from room temp. These are normally run at room temp. Maybe try running it at 0°C or minus 20°C. There are certain temperatures that are easy temperatures to achieve. Minus 20, zero is with the ice. Minus 20 is certain salt solutions will get you down to minus 20 with ice. They'll cool it down even more. If you need to go to minus 76, dry ice and acetone is minus 76 temperature. That would be too slow. That would be taking us way down. Concentrations. Sterling is also giving us concentrations. So what do we want to do with concentration there?
You want to decrease the concentration.
Okay, so when we were looking at rates before and we said that the rate here was equivalent to the concentration of the calcone times the ethyl acetoacetate, that if I decrease the concentrations, that could slow this reaction down. So maybe two, decrease concentration of reactants, which might mean more solvent. Okay. Give me another one. Catalysts don't show up in the rate law. And so the sodium hydroxide doesn't show up in the rate law, but the sodium hydroxide plays into this first step here in creating the amount of enolate that is present in the solution. So what's another way that we might affect this through the sodium hydroxide?
Decrease the concentration of sodium hydroxide.
Yeah, there's two ways to do this. So we can decrease concentration of sodium hydroxide. So we started off from like 12 molar. Maybe we could drop this down to like the 2.2 molar. So that's one way to do it. Or another way is to decrease volume of sodium hydroxide. So we were running this and looking back to see what we had calculated, 0.44 mils. So we had 0.44 milliliters. Maybe we could just take this down to a drop or two of sodium hydroxide, which would also effectively decrease the concentration. So those are two ways to decrease the concentration of sodium hydroxide. And yeah, these are all ways to slow the reaction down. And so what we would do then is we would reset the chemical reaction and we would choose one of these and give it a shot and see what happens in terms of that chemical reaction and trying to slow it down and see if that works or not. So we could first off try cooling the reaction down to 0 degrees C and running it in an ice bath and throwing in the sodium hydroxide and seeing if that was sufficient. If not, we could drop it down colder to minus 20. We could change to a larger round bottom and add more solvent. We could decrease the concentration and use a lower concentration of sodium hydroxide, or just decrease the volume of sodium hydroxide. We sort of have to pick a direction and go a direction and try it and do some experimentation. What I'll tell you is that the nitro derivative was in the original Pavia textbook in the first and second versions of the textbook. And after that, the nitro derivative was removed and not given as an option for this experiment. And when I talked to Pavia and I asked him why they removed it, he said because nobody could make it work and they had lots of complaints from chemistry instructors that the nitro derivative just didn't work and that students couldn't make it work. Turns out that the nitro derivative, if you use just two drops of the 2.2 molar sodium hydroxide, goes beautifully. So just decreasing the amount of sodium hydroxide, running it at room temperature, the reaction actually does go quite nicely. And it just takes decreasing that rate through dropping the sodium hydroxide into it. Now, I haven't tried temperature or solvent, but just working through the sodium hydroxide is a fairly easy thing to adjust. And you can add a drop, watch it, add another drop, watch it, and sort of sneak up on how much sodium hydroxide it takes before you start seeing precipitate coming out of the chemical reaction, which is the formation of the calcone. And you can sort of titrate to figure out how much sodium hydroxide it requires in order to make it go well. And that's how we ultimately figured it out. And so I have kept the nitro derivative as an option for this experiment, even though the book doesn't give it, just because I know that we can make it work. And it's kind of satisfying to make something work that other people couldn't and took out of the textbook. It's just kind of this nice thing to learn that you just have to keep your eyes open in order to figure out how to make things work sometimes. All right, what else do I want to show you? I think that's about it. One thing that I mentioned with the morning class was it's one thing to watch somebody go through and scale things. It's another thing to have to go through and scale a reaction. So what I think I'm going to do is put together a little exercise for the lab of just scaling a couple of different reactions and giving you the reactions as they're set and asking you to scale them to a certain size and to pick out the size glassware that you would use after going through and doing that. And it's not going to be a big assignment. It's just going to be a couple of things. Just give you some practice so that it cements it a little bit more so you don't forget it. So I'll put something together like that. I think that I will do it after the test, however, so that I know you guys are busy and focusing on the test, and then we'll put that in place after the test. Okay. And I think that's all I've got for today. So a little bit shorter day today.
And will you want that in the lab notebook or you?
No, it's just something to just turn in for the lab component. It's just on separate sheets of paper. It doesn't have to be in the lab notebook. Okay. How about any other questions that we had? Reaction theory or other?
This is a question I had during lecture, but it honestly kind of does relate slightly to this. I was just thinking about, like, we've talked about a lot of reactions where you get different yields, and we've also been talking about the change in enthalpy from like hydrogenating a benzene versus like a monosubstituted ring. And so I'm kind of wondering where, like, we've done some of the substitutions for the aromatics, and then like figured out this some direct meta and some direct ortho para. So there's obviously like differences in energy for forming those products, right? And so my question is like in Chem 1B, we were always just given these, or even 1A, it was just these like super simple like reactions, and we just use like measure the change in temperature and assume like this is the heat evolved and all that stuff, right? But how, like, in you have one reaction container that's evolving multiple reactions, each with different heats of or like, you know, enthalpies of formation or whatever. And so how do you distinguish one reaction from the other if you want to actually figure out what the enthalpy of reaction is for, like, say the ortho para directing one? How do you do that?
I don't know. Okay, full disclosure, it's my least favorite topic.
Oh.
It's complicated when you start to have a lot of different intermediates and you have a complicated chemical reaction as it takes place. I mean, when we look at the reaction overall, the heat of formation really is not just the change, but I guess, you know, it's what is it, Hess's law, that says that any way that we can add different reactions together to get to the product that is desired is valid, and that the sum is path independent, so that we can take different pathways to get to that product. And no matter which pathway we take, when we add all those reactions out together, we always arrive at the same value. I think that's Hess's law. And the same is true of when we want to measure the enthalpy change for these different chemical reactions, in that if we put them in a bomb calorimeter or in a really good calorimeter, essentially, and we measure the heat change for the chemical reaction, and we understand the number of reactants that we put in the reaction, so we understand the number of millimoles that we're dealing with or whatever, that we can calculate out the enthalpy change for the chemical reaction based on the change in heat that we're seeing, and it's path independent. So we don't need to worry about all the different things that are being created in that. It should still give us the same information, I think, is the right answer.
So,
but I'm prefacing that with, I'm thinking on my feet and it is not my favorite topic. I'm much more interested in what it is that I can create, in the reactions that I can run, the things that I can make, and the tools that I can use in order to accomplish those reactions. And by tools, I mean the literal pieces of equipment, the round bottoms, and all the things that I get to assemble and play with. And
Jason, you're making us jealous. We didn't get to do any of this.
I know. And this is one of my favorite things with special projects, is sometimes there's a tool that we do. You know, when we do sublimations, you know what sublimation is. So you take a material and you heat it up, and the material goes from solid phase to gas phase. There are certain materials that you can purify by sublimation. And what they do is they take the material and they put it in a container.
I think you froze again.
Showing on my screen. I didn't start a drawing yet. I was thinking. And what they do is they put an ice trap over here. So there's cold. This is a cold trap. And in this cold trap, they then have another bulb over here, which is connected to a motor in the middle. And on this side, they have heat. And so this side is heated up, and they start their material over here. And there's a motor essentially that rotates this thing. And so this is going up and coming down. So the whole thing rotates. And the material goes into the gas phase, travels over to the cold side, and precipitates out. And it's a German apparatus called a Kugelvor. And it's a bulb-to-bulb distillation is what it's called. And in one of the special projects, we needed a Kugelvor. And I had seen them made before with windshield wiper motors from a car, where the windshield wiper motor causes the thing to rotate and go back and forth. And you literally put a hot water bath on this side and a cold bath on this side. And it's held in place by a board where these are connected with a ground glass joint. And then the windshield wiper motor rotates the thing. And we didn't have that. So what we did is we needed a Kugelvor. So we took a coffee pot, essentially, that has the heating element in the coffee pot, an old school sort of coffee pot. And we just cut a hole in the coffee pot and jammed two round bottoms together. And then we put the material that we wanted to heat inside the coffee pot round bottom. And then we put a cold bath on the outside and we just spun it by hand. And then we wrote Kugelvor on it, and it was just, and it worked. I mean, but it's this idea of sometimes you know what it is you want to achieve and you don't have the money to be able to create the glassware, but the concept is there. And you look around the lab and you see what it is that you have, and you create from what you have. And it's that part of special projects that I absolutely love, is we need to get to the next level. We need to do the next reaction, or we need to analyze the product, and we don't have the exact tools that we need, but we take the concept and we say, how can we make this concept work? How can we analyze it? How can we do it? And that's the fun part to me. That's the part that I've always enjoyed. It's coming up with solutions to be able to do things, both chemistry and working around reactions that we couldn't do, finding new ways to do reactions, or finding ways to analyze reactions, and also equipment-wise, how do we make the equipment work? And those are my two favorite aspects. And the energy component, I've always struggled with for some reason. And it's not the math, because I love the math. I think it's just, I don't really care about the energy change. I just want to hold the thing in my hand and see it, or I want to do it.
Because you're an industrial chemist.
Yeah, and so the energy part of it has just never been the fun part for me. And I recognize that those are totally valid questions and can be interesting questions and can also influence how you design a chemical reaction. Because if you understand the energetics of it, then you can design to scale up that reaction to handle the energy. And so that's where you're really starting to look at chemical engineering, is how do I take a reaction that you do on a 5 millimole scale, and how do I scale that up to make metric tons of it, right? And so the facility has to be able to handle the caustic nature of the chemicals. They have to be able to handle the heat changes of the chemicals. They have to handle the expansion that could happen for those materials when there are temperature changes and all of those types of things. And that's all the chemical engineering stuff. That's all fascinating stuff. It's really cool. It's just not my area.
That's so, okay. Yeah. On that note, in the coming fall, wherever I end up going, which we probably know where I'm going, but like, how do I approach asking a professor or like trying to get into someone's lab to work, but be like, I've had Chem 1A experience, so come at me. I'm fierce.
I'm going to leave the recording on because this is an important thing. That's going to be really hard, but everybody's going to be in the same boat. It's not like other people had lab experience and you didn't, and you're at a disadvantage. Everybody's at a disadvantage. And the faculty are going to have to realize that they're going to have to train people and work with people, and that it's not going to be it's not going to be standard for a while, and that people are going to have some big lab deficits that we're going to have to make up. I don't think the skill of getting into a lab changes. And I don't think that anytime it's really about your skills by hand, because the instructor has no way to evaluate your hand skills and how you function in lab, because they're not going to have you in lab, and you're trying to get into a lab that you may not have a relationship with that instructor, with those grad students. So how do you actually get into a lab and start to get that type of experience? So this is something that I frequently, I'm gonna stop the screen share so you guys can see me a little bit bigger. This is something that that I frequently discuss as we start getting to the end of lab and people are starting to look at the universities where they're transferring to, and how do I get undergraduate lab experience? How do I get research experience? If I can't get into an internship over the summer, how do I break into one of these labs and get into these labs? And there's a number of different ways. One way, the way that worked for me was as I transferred to the university and I was an undergraduate, I was in advanced organic chemistry. And in that advanced organic chemistry class, I wound up doing some chemistry or proposing some chemistry that was too dangerous to do in the undergraduate lab. And so they moved me to the research lab. And the graduate student who moved me in there with the permission of the professor, I wound up making a fairly good relationship with them. And as they were watching me work in the graduate lab, they realized that I had some skills and wound up working that way. But making that relationship with a grad student is sometimes challenging. So here's the best way that I've found to make this work. All right, well, let me tell you the way not to make it work. Do not take a resume and go to the professor's lab and say, here's my resume, and I'm really good, and I'm really excited, and I'd like to work in your research group, and here's my resume. They're gonna put that resume down, and it's gonna find its way into the recycling bin like really quickly. And they're not gonna call you back because they don't have any relationship with you. They don't know you, they don't trust you. And getting into a research lab is all about trust. It's about knowing that the individual that you're placing into that dangerous, difficult environment is trustworthy to not do stupid shit. That's basically what it comes down to. And so the way to do that is that all faculty that have research groups that are active in research, they hold research group meetings usually once a week. Those research group meetings are oftentimes in the late afternoon. Sometimes they're in the morning. It depends on the research group. And they hold those meetings so that they can discuss the different projects that are going on within the research group with the faculty member. And the faculty member has a check-in with everybody and sort of sees what's going on, and everybody else sees what's going on. And it's a sharing of ideas. It's part of training of graduate students to have those research meetings and to also have literature days where they're presenting new ideas, where the graduate students are going and reading literature and they're coming back and presenting things that they found. Sometimes they'll have guest speakers come into those and talk about chemistry. So there's all kinds of different reasons why these research groups meet once a week, but it's fairly standard across all the different disciplines, be it biochemistry, biology, or chemistry. If you go into the research advisor's office and say, I'm really excited about your research, and I'm wondering if your research group meetings are open to undergraduates, and could I just come and sit and listen? You're not asking them for anything other than to listen. They don't have to trust you. They don't have to know you. They don't have to trust that you're not going to do so-called stupid shit, as I said before, in the lab, because that's not what you're asking to do. So you go to the research group meeting. They almost always say yes. I've never heard of anybody saying no. You go to the research group meeting and you listen and you go every week. And when they do literature days, you ask, hey, is there a list of journals that you generally look at? And is this something that I could do that maybe I could present? And you go and you present a literature item, right? You sit next to the graduate students and you ask them questions while the meeting is going on. Can you explain that to me? I don't understand that, right? Or you ask questions during the meeting and they explain it to you. Within about 3 weeks, all of a sudden, they're looking around and they have all this work to do. And they're looking at you like, how come you're not working? You're totally slacking. You're sitting in here and you're not doing anything. And all of a sudden you get invited to come and work on a project because now they trust you. Because now they know you, because you've shown that you're dedicated and you're showing up. And it may take more than 3 weeks, might take 6 weeks, whatever it takes. You integrate yourself into the research group through the meeting and you get to know people. And as they get to know you, you build trust. Trust then brings you into the research group and you become part of the group. And all of a sudden you have a home and a place to start. And you really didn't have to do anything special other than show that you were willing to show up. That's the right way to do it.
I like it. That's what we're going for.
Yeah. So you just, and what I would say is look at the research groups. You can look at the professor's research online. You can go to their websites and you can see their publications. You can see the type of work that they do. Pick a couple that you're interested in and then try to go to a couple of different research meetings and see where you feel like you fit best. Because fitting is not always the chemistry that is most exciting, but the people who you can work with the best, that you find the best working relationships with. The chemistry can come later and can be directed more later. It's really about finding that fit of where you're going to feel comfortable, because that's also, they're going to feel most comfortable with you. And that's where you're going to find a good working relationship. And you're going to find a professor that you respect and that you like and that you want to work with. And so be selective, be willing to look at a couple of different groups. Think of it more as you trying to find a home than trying to find somebody who's going to take you, right? That's more important, I think. So that's my other piece of advice there.
Appreciate it. That's good.
Okay. All right, you guys, I think that's all I got for you. I'll see you on Thursday, huh?
Sweet. Bye, Jason.
Okay. See you Thursday. Take care. BB, are you going to ask me a question? Or are you just hanging out?
I feel like I have a bunch of questions, but I'm trying to think about them.